Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome to this week's episode of the TLS podcast. I'm Thea Linarduzzi, an editor here at the TLS, and Lucy Dallas, our arts editor, is here with me. Hello, Lucy.
Hi, how are you doing?
I'm all right, thank you. What's new with you?
What's new in terms of things we've been discussing recently? I was having a look at the French papers the other day, and I saw a review of one of the Cazalet sagas.
Did you?
I thought it can't be the first translation, can it?
I don't know. How interesting. I wonder if they've been listening to this podcast.
Undoubtedly.
Who's published it?
I actually don't know. I should have taken notice of who's published it. It was the third volume, and the review was in Le Monde, and the review was by Florence Noiville, who's a very distinguished journalist and novelist, actually, writes for Le Monde. And it was a very, very good review, except at one point I had to say out loud, "No, it isn't." Because it's a very, very good perceptive review. And she said it's in the line of, you know, kind of English dynastic works. Like, she said the Forsyth saga, which I don't know enough to know about to know whether it is. She said Anthony Pole and something else. And then she said, and Downton Abbey.
Oh,
and
no.
And I went, no, it isn't. To an empty room.
How interesting.
Yeah, isn't that interesting? So they've got those delights happening.
That's good news.
How about
good news. Well, you know how a few weeks ago we read out the names of as many independent bookshops as we could to mark Independent Bookshop Week. Yes, it was a breathless episode.
It was.
Well, I've since had another submission, and I don't see why we shouldn't just keep the whole thing going forever. So I might just share that now, shall I?
Yeah, go for it.
Because I've heard from Eamon, who is a regular listener, and he wants to alert us to two bookshops. The first is in Buenos Aires.
Good, that is stretching our horizons.
It really is. So it's called Libreria Norte, and it was founded by the Argentinian poet Hector Yanovir. Eamon says that all of the writers of the Latin American boom, so Julio Cortazar and Carlos Fuentes and Mario Vargas Llosa and dear old Gabo, hung out there back in the day. And it's still run by the family. And it was founded in 1961, I found out. So we wish them a happy 60th birthday, which is nice. And there's also a little close to home for us now, and a much younger shop, because I think it opened just a few years ago. It's called La Lata Peinada, which is in Barcelona, and it specializes in Latin American literature. So this is obviously Eamon's specialism also, but it also does first editions and rarities. So there you go. An indie bookshop is not just for Christmas or a week,
it's for life.
But for life. Now, coming up on this week's show, Diary of a Provincial Lady, a hilarious fictionalized account of life in deepest Devon between the wars, was one of the 1930s most popular books. Indeed, it's never been out of print. Our writer Sarah Lonsdale rereads the novel now and finds perhaps more darkness and disquiet than she remembered. And Mary Beard finds new reasons to return to Rome's Colosseum just as soon as we're allowed. But first, Lucy, it's a special occasion.
It is. And if we were all in the studio today, no doubt we would have a great big cake with 150 candles on, because this week is the 150th birthday of one Marcel Proust, who casts a very long shadow over the rest of his century and beyond. A good moment then to survey the landscape and see what Proust means to us now. And happily, Adam Watt, Professor of French and Comparative Literature at the University of Exeter, did just that for us in a beautiful anniversary piece. We're delighted that he can talk to us today. So tisanes and madeleines at the ready. Adam, thank you very much for talking to us.
Thanks, Lucy.
let's talk about what Proust sort of means now, as it were. You say in your piece near the beginning that he has this extraordinary capacity to connect or reconnect us with a phenomenological, which is very difficult to say, with the phenomenological riches of life outside the window, which sounds like exactly what we've all been needing recently. Do you think lots of people turned to him in lockdown, and why would they do that?
I think they did. And I completely agree with you that phenomenological is one of the harder words to say. And I'm going to try and avoid saying it, having got it right first time there. Put more simply, Proust is all about the senses. And it's an odd thing to say, because people think about Proust as a writer of very long books, and it's dry and it's intellectual and it's, but that's not the case. He's someone who connects and reconnects us to the world around us in very particular and unexpected ways. And I think that a lot of people have turned back to Proust or picked him up for the first time in the course of the last 18 months or so, because, well, for a range of reasons, one of them being that he's a kind of challenge. Some people think of him as a kind of literary Everest because of the scale of the novel. The duration of the thing, we've been shut up for an awful long time, and it's a wonderful opportunity to immerse yourself in something that seems to improve the more time you commit to it.
And also he, as you say, you've got this brilliant phrase for him, a deserter from the army of the upright. He wasn't well himself, so he spent a lot of time basically observing from his window. And as you say, the language of illness and infection and confinement wouldn't be that new for him, would it, as you say?
That's right. So the that phrase, I can't claim originality in that phrase. That's actually borrowed from Virginia Woolf's essay on being ill.
That. If I were well read, I would know that. Sorry.
I just love that phrase. And he did famously spend an awful lot of his life in bed for various sorts of ill health and complaints. But yeah, as you say, that the language of disease, and there's an awful lot of specialized medical language and vocabulary in Proust's novel. And it's not just that he was self-obsessed, self-absorbed, and you know, he was the Belle Époque version of the person who looks up what's wrong with them on Google.
Google would have been hopeless for him, wouldn't it?
Oh, God, yeah. The roots of his medical obsession, which is probably a fair thing to call it, were in the fact that his father and then his younger brother were both not just doctors, but very, very highly esteemed, distinguished, successful, publicly visible men of science, men of medicine. So the medical world and the boundaries of medical knowledge and the very specifically epidemiology and trying to control disease spread was his father's bread and butter. So when you read À la recherche du temps perdu, when Proust reaches for a metaphor of contagion or disease, he goes into cell biology. There's just this extraordinary scope of the fields on which he draws for his metaphors and his analogies. A lot of that begins close to home, and the, you know, the books that were lying around the parental drawing room, as it were.
And I was thinking about it because you talk about the sensitivity as well. So there's a sensitivity in the sense that he had asthma and he couldn't breathe very well. He was very sensitive to sound. You know, we don't know exactly what was wrong with him physically, do we? Or maybe we do know exactly. But also he was very, very sensitive to language and to, as you say, what was happening, and to social interaction and to memory. And it's all about sensitivity, really, as though he's got a few layers of skin fewer than the rest of us.
That's right. And that's a nice way of putting it. I think it's risky to trace too many things back to a single complaint or trait of his character. But it is the case, we know, that when he was 10 years old, he had a very serious and sudden asthma attack that was quite unanticipated and left him close to death. It was hugely serious, and a shortage of breath and a very, very considerable sensitivity to air quality. They characterized his existence from then on. And he didn't live a terribly long life. He died when he was 51. But knowing that he had that medical condition is one way of understanding perhaps why he was such a very attentive observer, because he wasn't always able to be part of what was going on. He was always just at a little distance. He was absolutely passionate about nature and the beauty that you could find in nature. But this was something that also, to put it colloquially, that it would set him off. It would make his eyes run and it would make him wheeze. And quite literally, he couldn't go too close to the window on the Boulevard Haussmann because of the fear that he had. And some of it was neurosis. We don't know exactly how much this was a genuine medical condition, how much was in his mind, but he was terribly worried about breathing in what might be brought in from the street if the windows were open too far.
There's an image you talk about in Swan's Way of the church in Combray, which is a lightly fictionalized version of where he spent a lot of his childhood. You say that that image is a good encapsulation of what his novel represents now. Can you talk us through it?
Sure. So Proust's narrator has an extraordinary sensitivity to his surroundings. And of course, the most famous moment of Proust's novel is the Madeleine moment, which is all to do with memory and an unbidden, involuntary memory that kind of overwhelms him when he has this mouthful of Madeleine. And so that, if you like, sets the tone for the importance of the past and our relationship to it. And a little bit later in Combray, the first part of the first volume of the novel, the narrator describes the church in the town, which is probably the oldest building in the town. And it's one in which he feels a very, very powerful connection to the past. He feels not just that it's an old building, he feels that when you stand within a structure of that sort, you can somehow communicate with what has gone on before there. You have a deeper sense of lines running way beyond the measure of your own existence to much earlier times. And the way he does that is to talk about, he calls it an édifice occupant, si l'on peut dire, un espace à quatre dimensions, la quatrième étant celle du temps, so a four-dimensional space, and that the fourth is the dimension of time that is somehow perceptible in this space. And he gives temps a capital T. It's not just the time that clicks around on your watch, on your wrist, it's the longue durée, it's the sense of existence through time that he feels is present to us in a space like the church.
Given this, as you say, intense sensitivity to time, to the passage of time, on its effect on things, its effect on people, how did his relationship with the works change over time? He was a chronic reviser, wasn't he?
Absolutely, and that's a great question. He wrote this novel, which in many senses, simplistic and complex, is all about time. It's there in the title. But his own relationship to time is constantly in tension with his work on the novel. And you're absolutely right. He was a chronic recidivist reviser. He just couldn't leave stuff alone. He just always had to add and to add. And the proofs that one might expect to come back with a light dusting of grammatical adjustments and the odd typo, in fact, came back almost doubled and tripled in volume because he just kept going.
The publishers must have been just furious with him, mustn't they? They'd have been like, oh, not again.
The moments when the proofs were being corrected, the letters that you find at those points are just, some of them are hilarious. The forbearance and the patience of Gallimard as Proust, sends back screeds and screeds of extra stuff. They have to completely repage set over and over again. But the whole thing becomes a race against time because Proust is already 42 when Du Côté de chez Swann is published in 1913. And the book he initially had planned as a two-volume work, then a three-volume work, and then as the Great War unfolds, his illness means that he's not able to be a combatant. He remains in Paris and he just keeps writing and keeps writing and keeps writing. And so the book grows and grows. But his commitment to it and his realization of what it could be and what a kind of lasting contribution it might be to our understanding of ourselves and the world that we're in means that he has this weird schedule of turning his days inside out and working through the night, not eating very much, drinking huge amounts of coffee, taking a whole range of stimulants to keep himself going. And as a result, his health gets worse and worse. So He can see that this is going to be the work that he's always dreamed of it being, but he's also aware that his time is diminishing.
Part of the exploration of time, and you say it's one of the things that makes him a great modernist novelist, along with, you mentioned Joyce and Woolf, which might seem a bit surprising to begin with. I mean, they also play with time, but very differently. I was thinking about it and thinking, well, that's what they do is much more compact. And then that seems a mad thing to be saying, oh, look how compact Ulysses is, or Mrs. Dalloway.
Famously compact.
And no, but actually, in relation to A la Recherche, it kind of is, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's a different, completely different thing they're doing.
One of the things that struck me years ago when I was a doctoral student, and it still does, that you read, if you read academic criticism or you read work about the 20th century novel or, you know, the modernist novel or whatever it is, so often you find a sentence that groups together Proust, Joyce, Kafka, Wolfe. They've almost become one word. And they are taken as one, as modernist writing. But actually, when you break it down to compare, you know, Mrs. Dalloway or Ulysses with A la Recherche du Temps Perdu is to compare wildly different books, wildly different structures, wildly different ambitions for what can be achieved between the covers of those volumes.
And never mind Kafka.
Yeah.
You're saying about the life, it feels like he's a sort of concertina. It kind of opens out like a concertina or like a fan, I suppose.
Yes, and that's the concertina is a wonderful image. And Proust is full of, I mean, that's a apposite for a range of reasons, partly because Proust was absolutely passionate about music. And the image is a good one because the concertina opens and closes. And that's one of the things that people find most challenging, I think, about reading Proust, is that you can have a very, very long sentence that describes a very, very short moment. And you can also have a very short sentence that covers really quite a big chunk of time. And those kind of expansions and contractions of chronology within the novel exist alongside jumps back and forward in time. So you have moments of anticipation where he jumps forward and talks to you about something that he would later know, but that hadn't happened yet. And equally, you'll have a moment of flashback of reflection on something that happened, you know, way back when, or even something that happened a few days ago, but that he hadn't mentioned.
There's been a lot of, I'm going to say this in quotation marks, if that's possible, new, as it were, Proustian discoveries made recently, haven't there? There seems to be a tremendous appetite to find out about him, but also for people to link it to their own lives. They kind of add their own biography to his. Does that make sense?
Yeah. There's been a huge amount of interest. The principal source of recent discoveries are the archives of Bernard de Fallois, who's one of the pioneers of Proust scholarship. He died in 2018, and his personal archive has been explored and mined for a lot of things that scholars knew would be there, but other things that appeared that weren't known about. And so that's the, you know, part of the new discoveries of Proust that we've seen in recent years. The compulsion to it, sort of attach one's own biography or to read one's own biography through the Proustian lens is something that it is quite common, partly I think because something that maybe we don't draw enough attention to. One of the most extraordinary things about a novel of this length is that it's a first person novel. We are constantly in the company of someone who says I, and we feel like we know them, you know, that sort of experience of proximity.
You also talk about the cultural capital that his work has, which is, you know, huge, and the people that he's influenced. I'm talking about some recent late 20th century, early 21st century stuff, like the graphic novelist Alison Bechdel and the filmmaker Wes Anderson. What do they do with him?
Bechdel is wonderful, and I think the graphic novel has a long and very distinguished history in French. You know, the bande dessinée is something that culturally is not frowned upon or kind of pushed to the side as a something that's for children or is a bit weird or anything like that. It's fascinating to read Fun Home, which gives this important place to Proust. I mean, there are so many other writers that feature and that kind of shape Fun Home. Proust is there because of the central position that he gives in the novel to a discussion of same-sex desire, to homosexuality, to something which hadn't been frankly addressed at length in the way that Proust did. And it's a perfect sort of vehicle for Bechdel's narrative about her narrator's father's struggle with his own sexual identity and her narrator's own developing understanding of who she is. Sexually. So, you know, the Alain de Botton book, How Proust Can Change Your Life, was a real milestone in the crossover, if you like, between Proust as high culture and Proust as mainstream, accessible, and in, you know, in his case, self-help. So Bechdel does a very, really quite a highbrow, but also multi-layered handling of Proust. In The Life Aquatic, you know, you could blink and miss it, but the fact is that it's built in there that Cate Blanchett's character is seen in this very weird, very male dominated environment reading Proust, and there's something about her self-confidence and her own cultural capital that she is reading Proust to her as yet unborn child.
I was wondering about that, because I was thinking, well, is it people just putting it in to kind of look clever? So I did a bit of reading, and Wes Anderson he's read Swan's Way, he said. He hadn't read all of it, but he'd read Swan's Way. And he said it took him ages.
Yeah.
Which is honest of him.
But I wonder which translation he read.
I don't know, actually. And he said that it gave the images from it were still in his head. And so I was just looking around a little bit, and I found a website. This is almost by the by, but I felt like I was caught in a kind of Proustian time loop. There's a website called Accidentally Wes Anderson, where they take pictures of things that look as though they should be in a Wes Anderson film. It's extraordinary. And one of those pictures was the station, Illier, which is the town where Proust actually did spend his time, but the station has been renamed Illier-Cambray in homage to Proust. So they've actually changed the name of it. So there's a picture of an absolute perfectly Wes Anderson-like French provincial small train station, and it says Illier-Cambray. And then there's a thing there, there's a little sign saying this is the name of the, you know, this is both the real town and the name of the Proustian town. And I thought, gosh, I have to stop. I've gone down a rabbit hole.
that's wonderful. Accidentally Wes Anderson.
Yes.
The point about Illier-Cambray is an interesting one in that the town Illier was Proust's father's hometown, and he spent most of his childhood summers in Illier. And because Proust's stock rose through the 20th century and he became this great icon of literary achievement, in 1971, so the centenary, the town as a whole changed its name formally to Illier-Cambray. And so now that's this weird overlap or fusing of life and fiction.
That's extraordinary.
It's an interesting point. I wonder where else you could do that. I mean, there'd be so many potential places to bridge that gap and rename places.
Yeah.
Sense a new trend, perhaps.
Let's start a website. And finally, Adam, you say that towards the end of your piece, you say that Proust claims that creative work functions as a sort of optical instrument, a lens through which you can see yourself and your world more clearly. Does this still hold true for him and the work, do you think?
I think it does, but I think it maybe does so in ways that are different to those that he might have had in mind when he was writing those lines. I guess what I mean by that is, one of the things I know that puts people off reading Proust now is the kind of snobbishness, if you like, that's the shorthand that people use, that here is a book which has great tracts of it that are dedicated to the upper crust in Paris around the turn of the century. And I don't think many of us, you know, feel like that's much of a lens for the life that we lead today. But I don't think that's what Proust means. And I think that genuinely this is a work that resonates with us. And I think what I was trying to get at towards the close of the piece was that if we see beyond that to the personal, to the profound, to the observational stuff, there are lots of social scenes where we're in amongst the gratin, the upper crust of Paris. But the narrator isn't a native of that world, and he's always just on the edges of it. Even if he's, you know, sat at the table with these people, he's observing and he's thinking about them, and he's as interested in the servants below the stairs as he is in the people in these parties. But the narrator is constantly observing, constantly filtering and weighing things up and hypothesizing about why things are. And I think if we take the time, and COVID has given us that time in a weird way, if we take the time to immerse ourselves in the world of this individual and his vision, we can start looking at our own world differently. You know, that's a wonderful thing.
Brilliant. Well, thank you so much. I feel like we could go on in loops for a long time, but unfortunately our time is finite here. But thank you so much for talking to us. And let's raise a glass to 150 years. Thank you very much, Adam.
Indeed. Thanks. Great pleasure.
Still to come on the show, Mary Beard revisits the Colosseum, dispelling a few myths along the way, and Sarah Lonsdale encounters a surprisingly modern spirit in a novel about small-town life in the late 1930s. And if you've enjoyed what we've discussed so far this week, let me remind you that you can subscribe to this podcast for free wherever you normally get your podcasts, and you'll never miss an episode. And we are happy to announce the return of the exclusive TLS subscription offer. Exclusive, that is, to our podcast listeners. For just £5 or $5, or the equivalent in whatever currency you use, you will receive 6 issues of the TLS, and that's print and digital. So you'll have the paper turning up on your doorstep every week, where you'll find all the pieces we've talked about on this podcast, alongside dozens of other pieces, as well as getting access to everything online and in the app edition, should you find yourselves waiting for a bus without your print issue handy. The digital access also includes the website and app archives and the historical archive, which goes back to 1902. So you can look up Walter de la Mare and T.S. Eliot and read what Virginia Woolf made of D.H. Lawrence, Joseph Conrad and Aldous Huxley. There's original writing by Roland Barthes, Saul Bellow, John Updike, Muriel Spark, Chinua Achebe, Patricia Highsmith, Umberto Eco and Susan Sontag, and poems by Hardy, Auden Frost, Plath, Larkin, Brodsky, Paul Muldoon and Anne Carson. So there's really quite a lot to be getting on with. Go to the-tls.co.uk/pod to take up this offer.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous 2-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Welcome back to the TLS podcast. Before we turn to Sarah Lonsdale and Diary of a Provincial Lady, we're joined by our classics editor, Mary Beard, to tell us about some new developments at the Colosseum in Rome. Mary, it's lovely as ever to have you here with us.
Nice to be with you. Good news as well from Rome.
Yes, always good to have some good news from Italy. It's not a country that abounds in good news. But you have been writing specifically about the Colosseum and about how really it's always looked better from the outside. But this is the good news. This is what's changing.
Yeah. Well, I up to now, I know I wrote a book about the Colosseum, and in some ways I'm very interested in it. I've always thought that it was a bit of a lousy tourist experience. I mean, it looks brilliant from the outside. And you know, up until the pandemic, you'd have seen queues, sometimes hours long, waiting to get into it. And when you got into it, it was all, well, frankly, a bit of a ruin, you know, and there weren't many places you could go. And you know, I used to often go and watch mums and dads, you know, and the kids had said they were being taken to Rome. Where do you want to go? I've got to go and see the Colosseum. And they got in, and you know, mums and dads were really working overtime to try to keep these kids' interest up, because it just wasn't quite as good as they'd imagined.
I mean, I was one of these kids, so I I feel it only too strongly.
Yeah, I think I was too, because you get in and you think, well, where were the lions? What?
I remember my dad saying, yes, they used to flood the whole place and there were these incredible naval scenes, and I was just really struggling to imagine it amid the dust.
Yes, and you can see why the sort of dress up gladiators who charge an extortionate amount to let you have your picture taken with them outside the Colosseum in one of Rome's great tourist attractions. You can see why they do such good business, because when mum and dad and the kids come out, you know, mum and dad are desperate and they think 20 euros for one snap with a gladiator, it's worth it. But, you know, things are looking up. And I think what's partly been disappointing about the Colosseum in general on the inside has been that really there has been so few places you could go. And what has just been opened up is the basements. The basements are actually quite exciting because they're where the animals were, probably to some of the gladiators, where they waited before they went up into the arena, you know, through a carefully arranged, you know, set of contraptions of lifts and pulleys and whatever. And what you're going to be able to do now is go down and see how that kind of substructure of the Colosseum worked. I mean, it's a bit more impressive than downstairs at Downton, really, but it's got the same idea behind it. I mean, what did it look like if you were one of the terrified victims of it? And the basements were underneath what must have been a wooden floor, and there would have been trapdoors in the wooden floor, and many of the performers, if we can call them that, would have emerged through the floor to meet their fate. So it gives you a much more rounded experience, but also, I mean, you know, in a very simple way, it just gives you something more to do, another sort of vista on it, because I think that's been the real problem, that it's a bit of a ruin and then there's not much to explore, and most of the places you'd like to explore up to now have been, or at least since I've been visiting the Colosseum. It does make the Colosseum something where you'd actually recommend people might go, whereas in the past I've always said, enjoy it from the outside.
Well, and it's a huge space that they've opened up, this underground backstage. It's some 15,000 square metres, isn't it? And this is, I mean, you've hinted there with the trapdoors and that sort of thing. This is where all of the amazing technology of the time would have been. So my dad trying to keep me interested with stories about flooding the stage for naval battles. This is where all the pipes would have been and all of that.
Your dad was absolutely right. It's still a mystery how they did that bit. I mean, we do have a pretty good idea about how the lifts and the pulleys and the ropes work to get up animals through the floor. No one's ever quite understood how they managed to flood the arena. In a way, the Colosseum's in a good place for flooding anything, because it was built on the site of Nero's private lake in his vast palace. And it's pretty damp. If you go, one of the things I remember about going into the basements is that the water table's pretty high, and it can be a bit soggy. How they managed to turn that into a full-scale lake with a naval battle on it, heaven only knows. I mean, either they were brilliant, we don't quite know how, or the Romans were very easily impressed by a tiny bit of water and a few model boats.
But you also say that actually if you could go back in time in there, you wouldn't go back to Roman times.
No.
Which was intriguing.
I mean, of course I'm a bit curious. How could you not be curious to what it was really like? But I think it would have been, I don't think it would mean a very comfortable visit. I mean, I'm curious as a historian, but, you know, I don't really fancy an afternoon seeing a load of people slaughtered, a load of animals slaughtered. And, you know, I've often thought, when would I best like to go back to the Colosseum? And I have no doubt now that the mid-19th century AD would have been the perfect time, because it was then at its real height of being a romantic monument. It was a bit less dilapidated than it is now, not hugely less, but it was before it had been turned into an archaeological site. And it was basically the most fantastic botanical garden, whole of the inside, instead of being rather kind of unpleasant, kind of brutally clean rock stone seating. It was taken over by a myriad of plants. And some were plants that were really only known in the Colosseum in Europe. And people used to fantasize that the seeds of these plants had been brought over in the fur of the poor animals that had come from Africa and were going to be sadly slaughtered, and that they kind of were kept alive for hundreds of years in the microclimate of the Colosseum.
That sounds plausible to me. And your high water table and the damp, that would all help, wouldn't it?
Yeah, maybe that's the case. But it certainly had a kind of romantic tinge. It's like going to an exotic wilderness. But then, just to kind of add to the fun, is that there were some... there was a cast of characters who had fetched up there. In particular, there was a hermit, a resident hermit, who lived in his little hermitage in the middle of the Colosseum. You could go and visit the hermit and see the plants. And so it was a kind of a wonderland experience.
I do lament the loss of the hermit.
Yes. What a great job.
Bring the hermit back.
It must be the most romantic thing imaginable, because not only is it the ruins and the hermit and the garden, but they're real ruins. It's not a folly that some, you know, rich bloke had to build. They are genuine ruins that you could wander around.
That's absolutely right. And so it's like it kind of out follies a folly because it was real.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, having heard all of that, having heard of all of those wonderful descriptions, it's almost seems anticlimactic to ask you what the actual developments are still to come, because we're not going to get that Colosseum back, I don't think. Instead, we have a third phase of renovations and reconstructions to look forward to instead, and they're rather more modest but still good.
Yeah, they're still good. And in my dreams I still think, you know, oh, you know, give it to me and I'll replant it, but I think that's not very likely. Within the next 5-10 years, the other thing you're going to be able to do is to climb up high, because over the past couple of decades you haven't been able to go down low, but you also haven't been able to climb up to the gods in the Colosseum. And I managed to do that once when we were making a television programme. And it was a real eye-opener, actually. And I think that it will be great fun for people, because seating in the Colosseum for the audience was rigorously segregated by formal social rank. I mean, it's not just like at, you know, the opera house where, you know, the rich people have got the best seats and the people who can't afford much have got the worst. This was actually a legal requirement. You know, the senators sat on the front row, and the next down sat on the next row. And at the back were the women and the slaves, the very, very back, high up. And I'd always taught my students, you know, that this was a real interesting case of Rome enacting its social hierarchy in such a way the poorer women and slaves, they got a rotten view. You know, they were right up at the back, couldn't see anything. So, you know, they knew their place. Inadvertently, they gave them the best view. And I've always imagined subsequently, you know, the poor old senators, you know, sitting in their club class seats on the front row in the beating sun, because the shades of that were put over, the awnings that were put over the Colosseum didn't protect those on the front row, and being uncomfortably close to the action. I've always now imagined them turning around and looking up to the poor people at the very back and feeling slightly jealous of the women.
And it makes you think again about the phrase we use. You say, you know, you're sitting amongst the gods, or you're sitting up with the gods. And it's always said as a criticism, you know, like you're getting a raw deal. But actually, if you think about it again, it is the best seat in the house, isn't it? It's divine.
Yeah, it is the best seat. And you just get, yeah, it is like, you know, you're watching from Mount Olympus and you can see everything and no one's getting in your way. Very strongly raked, so you know, you can have people in front of you, but you still easily see over their heads. And it is, you know, it is just a fantastic play. If you want to watch, if you want to watch men killing each other and men killing animals, it's by far the best place to do it.
There's your tip. Or if you just want to hang out.
On that lovely image, we will say goodbye for now. Thank you so much, Mary Bird.
Thanks very much.
When in December 1929, the literary magazine Time and Tide ran the first instalment of a new serial, Diary of a Provincial Lady, no one, not even the magazine's visionary editor, Lady Margaret Rhonda, could have foreseen how popular the stories would become. Indeed, as our writer Sarah Lonsdale points out this week, attached to the first submission was a handwritten note from the author, E.M. Delafield, recommending the waste paper basket as a useful receptacle for unwanted short fiction. Yet, Sarah says, from that first week, the diary's protagonist would become one of the most popular fictional creations of the 1930s, entertaining readers who saw in her only too much of themselves and guiding them through the political decade of financial depression, rapidly mutating social relations, and the rise of extremism. Sarah Lonsdale joins us now to discuss the enduring power of Delafield's fiction. Sarah, thank you for coming on.
It's a pleasure. Hello.
Diary of a Provincial Lady it's never been out of print, but I don't think that necessarily means that everyone knows what it is or would consider picking up a copy. I think given the title, many people might expect something quite quaint and conservative, maybe, which isn't really the case. So would you give us an introduction?
Yes. So Diary of a Provincial Lady is literally that. It's the diary, day-to-day doings of a woman who lives deep in the Devon countryside with her rather taciturn husband and her two small children and Madame Roselle, who is the governess of their daughter, Vicky. And on the surface, it does seem to be a terribly banal and rather dull proposition. She goes to her Women's Institute meetings, talks to the neighbours, she plants her spring bulbs, she holds fundraising fun fairs in her garden, plays tennis badly, and she goes to drinks parties dressed badly. And very little goes on. She occasionally goes to Plymouth to pawn and then buy back her wedding ring whenever things get a bit tight. And very often she has to deal with a broken oven and the food always being undercooked.
But I mean, I suppose that the fact that it first appeared in Time and Tide, a feminist socialist magazine, and that the book was later published by Virago as well. I mean, these are clues to the spirit of the work.
Yes. So E.M. Delafield herself was a director of Time and Tide and was a very strong feminist. She was good friends with Lady Rhonda as well. And what she wanted to do, I think, with Diary of a Provincial Lady is lay bare the realities of married women's lives in the very late 1920s and through the 1930s. Particularly those women, I think, who now were given an education of some sort, possibly not university, but certainly through school, but then had to face marriage where they were very much the inferior partner. Yet women were brought up to think that the only thing that they should do and should aspire to in life was to get married and have children. And she was really exposing, I suppose, the lie really at the heart of middle class society.
And lie is an interesting word because, of course, you describe the narrator protagonist as a serial liar. So, I mean, this is part of the point, is to show up how we're all liars, I suppose, lying constantly throughout the day to ourselves and to others, being lied to, that, you know, lies are what society and circumstance seem to demand of us, all of them.
Yes, she does lie to not hurt people's feelings, but she also lies because it's much easier to lie rather than tell the truth. But she gets confused. So there are certain points where she feels she should have told the truth, but she didn't have the courage to do so. And it's really interesting. I mean, the very first entry, which is dated November the 7th, 1929, says, "Plant the indoor bulbs. Just as I'm in the middle of them, Lady Box calls. I say, untruthfully, how nice to see her." That's the very, very opening line. And she's already told the lie. And I counted up, there were several, you know, in the first entry. So yes, mendacity goes all the way through it.
I love the way she lies. She often does lie just because she just wants to get out of a conversation, doesn't she? There's one where she's talking to, I think, a military man at dinner. And he talks to her about stag hunting, and he says the stags like it, really. There's absolutely nothing wrong with it. And it's a wonderful, good, old-fashioned English sport. And she says, I just said, yes, it is, because that was so much easier. And there's quite a few of those. It's very funny.
Yes. And actually, I mean, that's a really good point about her position within this very rural, very feudal country society, is that she admits to us, you know, she's terrified of dogs. She hates hunting. She can't play tennis. Yet she's in this society which sort of relies, those are the sort of warp and weft of the society she lives in. And that was actually very much E.M. Delafield. She married this rural agent for a big house. And she was a bit of a fish out of water. Again, a lot of us feel, don't we, we're imposters wherever we go. At a dinner party or a drinks party or you know, even at work. And again, she was sort of showing us that there's nothing to be ashamed of in that.
When did you first read the diary then? Because, I mean, this is part of our rereading series where people do precisely that. So how did you first read it, and how does that differ now to reading it in 2021?
I first read it many, many, many years ago, actually. It was just part of, I was starting to get to know kind of so-called middle-brow fiction, and I read her, I read Rose Macaulay. I did remember finding her hilarious and absolutely a tonic, really, compared to some of the other 20s and 30s literature I read. And it was during lockdown when we were all, let's face it, looking for something to cheer us up. And I did laugh. I laughed out loud many times, but what I realised, and maybe it was something to do with the times we're living through, there's sort of a darkness behind the gaiety and the sort of hilarity came through much more strongly than I ever remembered when I first read it.
And I suppose that's an inevitable thing, because, you know, the first time you read it, you would inevitably focus more on the humour, the surprise of it, I suppose, especially in the context of the rest of your reading at the time. But on second reading, with that element of surprise gone, it does kind of clear the way for other things to bubble up to the surface. You mention revenge along with regret, and you say most richly self-deception all form strong psychological undercurrents here.
But another thing that really interests, because after I reread the diary, I also started rereading some of her short stories, for which she isn't actually that well known at all. And they are, some of them are actually really very dark. There's murder, adultery, there's jealousy. They're all there in her short stories. Some of them are literally only about 1,000 words long. And they're little brilliant gems. And I think actually they could do with being republished. So she, you know, they were there in her thinking, and they're very much there underneath the surface of the provincial lady.
But by the time the diary first started to appear, so late 1929, the author was she a known entity by this point? Or if she was, I mean, she published always as E.M. Delafield, and the gender neutral name there didn't really fool anyone. You mentioned a TLS review, which made me laugh.
Yes. So her mother actually was a fairly famous author. She was Mrs. Henry de la Pasteur. She had a very difficult and complicated relationship with her mother, who was rather overbearing, but she wanted to obviously differentiate herself from her mother from the start. She published her first novel actually in 1917, and that was followed on by several others all through the 1920s. And she was a very regular contributor also to several literary journals during the 1920s. So she was pretty well known, but this was a completely new departure. I mean, I know we shouldn't dismiss middle-brow writing. I mean, it's been dismissed for years.
We certainly
years.
Don't on this podcast, I should say. We
no, not at all. I don't.
We shun the term itself.
Yeah, it seems to me it's basically always used disparagingly, but it's not. It's as sharp as anything you'll read. This seems to me.
No, absolutely. This was a quite a bold departure for her. I mean, she was always interested in the lives of women, and often the domestic lives of women, and I think probably that's why middle-brow has been dismissed, because it focuses on the lives of women and their relationships with their children and their husbands and things like that. But this, you know, this was something completely new, this very staccato present tense delivery in the diary form. And of course, you know, we can see, can't we, that Bridget Jones is a direct descendant, I think, from the provincial lady.
Yeah, it made Bridget Jones seem much, well, I don't mean that it wasn't original, because of course it was original, but you did think, oh, okay, that's where it's from.
Yes, exactly. But I do prefer the provincial lady, because she talked about a lot more of the sort of the social concerns. You know, as I said, the sort of the depression, the rise of extremist politics. Whereas sometimes I felt Bridget Jones was possibly a bit too focused on the number of calories she was.
Well, I mean, we'll have to leave it there, really. I feel like there's a lot more to be said about Ian Delafield. I'm wondering, on a parting note, you're the author, Sarah, of a book called Rebel Women Between the Wars, Fearless Writers and Adventurers. Does Delafield feature there?
She does, yes. She's not one of my sort of main characters, but she's definitely in there. I talk about Time and Tide and the women who worked on Time and Tide, which was quite a rebellious publication, run by women for women, kind of thing. Really, the first of its kind. And she was, as I say, on the directors, and was definitely egging everyone on to sort of break the rules wherever they could.
And I think it's an anniversary year for Time and Tide this year. Actually, I was on a panel. I think it was earlier this year. I've completely lost the sense of what year it is, time passing, but I'm pretty sure it was this year, and there's a tremendous archive that people can access now, I think.
Yes, there is. In fact, I think I was on another panel. I think it was actually last year was the anniversary, but they had to delay it several times, unfortunately, because of the pandemic. Just over 100 years ago.
Well, Sarah Lonsdale, it's been a pleasure talking to you today.
Thank you very much.
That is all we have time for this week. Our thanks go to Adam Watt, Sarah Lonsdale and Mary Beard. Thank you for listening to this episode of the TLS podcast, produced by Ben Mitchell. We'll be back next week, but for now, from Lucy Dallas and from me, goodbye.